Welcome to a crazy special episode of Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent former federal officials and special guests for a dynamic discussion of the most important political and legal topics of the day. I'm Harry Littman. Today, in lieu of our normal roundtable of three of your favorite expert commentators, this discussion is among 10 and counting. We may have a few stragglers, expert analysts and good friends, a full crew of the people whom you hear from on cable every day, but today here in robust and dynamic dialogue with one another. We're bringing this special episode to you now because we're on the precipice of the first ever criminal trial of a former president with three others at various distances in the wings. And this big gathering gives us a chance to compare notes, respond to each other, and have dynamic discussions, debates, and disagreements. So there's so much ground to cover and so many voices that I want to try to jump right in. I will be the commentator wrangler. And so if you have something to say, raise your hands. I'll keep a cue, try to keep the answers brief so we can get to several topics. Okay, feds, let's do this. Let's start with the hearing. Is it 2 days? Is it less that Judge Juan Merchan is called in the New York DA case, growing out of Trump's attempt to keep damaging information out of the public eye before the 2016 election. What do we expect to happen? Can it really go 2 days, and why would it? Anyone? Norm Eisen.
Harry Littman.
Oh, wait, I mean Norm Eisen, former Trump impeachment counsel, and author of forthcoming book on this case, Trying Trump.
Oh, that Norm Eisen.
That one, yeah. Except no imitations.
Also known as Norm the Younger. We'll hear from the great Norm the Elder later. I don't think, now that we have the largely full record, there are some redactions in the pile of motions, replies, and affidavits that we got about the SDNY's last-minute document dump. I don't think that there is a there that is going to detain the judge for much more than a half day, perhaps a full day, and slow down the trial in this case. I think we are speeding towards a roughly mid-April trial date. There's just not enough of interest in these documents to detain us, nor is there any significant, it appears, we'll see what happens at the hearing, any significant responsibility on the part of the district attorney's office. They asked for many of these documents from the Southern District of New York over a year ago. Trump, pretty late in the game earlier this year, subpoenaed them. The SDNY changed course. Initially, they were not going to produce. They decided to produce. I think none of it is going to slow us down significantly. We are headed for a mid-April trial, give or take.
All right, others. And let's say that's right. It comes down to just a couple hundred pages of maybe impeachment material from Michael Cohen. But Merchan said it was going to be a two-day hearing. Do you think he was thinking then that just the question, the legal question of how much time does Trump need, would take up that amount? Or, you know, he had some peak about the production. Do you think he contemplates some kind of, you know, trying to figure out why the production was belated? John Dean, who is, of course, the legendary former White House counsel in the Nixon administration and author of too many novels to count. Sorry.
All nonfiction. Actually, unpublished novels. I'd like just like to add to the potential for protraction of the hearing is a very interesting observation by Business Insider over the weekend, where they have looked at the trials where Trump has showed up and discovered that the lawyers misbehave with great frequency. As they describe it, they dance for him. And he's going to be there to tomorrow and however long this hearing lasts. So I'm hopeful that Norm and Rinaldo and others who go can actually give maybe an answer to that question of whether the lawyers look like they're performing for the boss, because that's not what lawyers are supposed to do. They're supposed to represent him and somehow control him. And maybe that is just not a norm that any of the norms have seen in this case.
Jen Rubin.
Well, first
columnist for the Washington Post and host of Jen Rubin's Green Room podcast, please.
It's so nice to be here with all of you. I think two things strike me. One is that I think the responsibility of the Southern District of New York that waited for months and months and months, and then practically on the eve of trial, dumped these documents is going to come up. And Merchan may ask for some of those people to be present. He may ask for some kind of explanation. But looking from the outside, and I would turn to the former prosecutors, particularly the federal prosecutors among us, this just seems extraordinary and ridiculously irresponsible and sloppy. And the second thing I would say is that there really is no prejudice to Trump. The trial hasn't begun. He's going to have plenty of time to go through these documents. If we are to believe what we've heard from the district attorney's office, there are only a few hundred that have any relevance to this. So how long does that take? A few weeks at most. So I am surprised that we're going to have a hearing of this length, unless it's to give a good old tongue lashing to the Southern District of New York.
I count four former feds. Anyone want to take that challenge? Mary McCord, who the former acting assistant AG for National Security DOJ and co-host of the wildly popular podcast Prosecuting Trump.
Yeah, so I think another thing that the court is going to want to hear about, you know, Mr. Trump has argued essentially that the district attorney, Alvin Bragg, and the prosecutors at the Southern District of New York were working together, right? So that they were, that would mean that the Southern District was essentially part of the prosecution team. Now, Alvin Bragg has argued in his responsive papers, I think pretty persuasively, we absolutely were not part of the same team. He did not open his records to us. We would have loved to see those records, but he did not open his records to us. And I think there's another likely reason why they weren't really working together on any prosecutions. And that has to do with Alan Weisselberg, because if he received immunity from the Southern District of New York for his testimony, then Alvin Bragg had to stay as far away from that as possible because he can't use anything directly related to Weisselberg's immunized testimony, nor anything that they would learn because of that. So there was good reason to keep a separation. But I think that Judge Merchan is going to want to hear about that. He's going to want to hear directly, because right now that's not in the papers. There's lots of redactions in the papers that I think very well may be those redactions have to do with Alan Weisselberg. But I think that remains to be seen.
Do you think there'll be people testifying?
Well, I don't know why on earth you need 2 days if there aren't going to be some people testifying, because you don't need 2 days just to hear argument.
Well, Jen Shan, and we have four, and Jeff Toobin was a former prosecutor who I count. Let me quickly take second Mary and say, look, that for that year, there was this, it was a request, and there were reasons. It's SDNY, we know, doesn't always play that well in the sandbox, but they had reasons at least for what they were doing. And then I think that Trump, the subpoena drops January 18th, takes a couple months, but I think there are good reasons there too. That's fairly prompt as well. And I think if Merchan really digs very deep, he'll find the DA is blameless. And that should immediately resolve his focus to how much the point exactly you just made, how much time does Trump need? And once he's decided that, I don't think there need be a who hit John hearing, but he obviously was, you know, interested to even a little hot and bothered about it. I'm sorry. Yes. Karen Agnifilo, who is, among other things, a CNN contributor and the former Manhattan chief assistant DA. So this very office, and the host of the Legal AF podcast.
I think the wild card is whether Trump is going to argue there's Brady material in these materials. And he'll certainly going to try that, because that is the one thing that could have some legs and some traction to delay this even further, and potentially to argue and make an argument that there's something going on nefarious between the two offices, et cetera. So I think you're going to expect them to try to make hay out of all of this. And then I think you're going to see the DA's office be very clear that, look, this is not, these are separate offices, and they asked for this material. It's largely duplicative. But I think, it, barring anything really unusual, I think we'll see the trial go 30 days. This is just to be a delay of 30 days total. So that's what I suspect we'll see tomorrow.
And we should raise a quick distinction between the Brady material or things that there's a constitutional right for the defense to have because it's exculpatory. And then there's a sort of similar category of material that is important to have to impeach a witness. And I think our understanding, you will certainly hear Trump say 100,000 pages, say I need at least 3 months. Actually, I need you to dismiss the whole thing. But it seems we'll know tomorrow, as Mary says, but when push comes to shove, it's maybe a couple hundred of pages that could help them in the cross-examination of Michael Cohen. They need a little time for that, but yeah, it is hard to see why it would be more than 30 days.
Can I just I just add a historical note, which, you know, those of us
that would be Jeff Toobin, the historically famous former federal prosecutor and legal analyst and author.
The idea that the Southern District and the Manhattan DA's office are colluding happily together is so contrary to their history that they I started covering this world and being a part of it when Robert Morgenthau was the longtime Manhattan DA. He was fiercely rivalrous with the Southern District, which he, back in the Kennedy administration, he was the U.S. attorney. The turf fights between the Southern District and the Manhattan DA are legendary. Mary Jo White, went to bat against the Manhattan DA many times. And this, too, as far as I can tell, is rooted in the lack of cooperation between the Manhattan DA and the Southern District, rather than some kind of collusion. But Trump's lawyers, being good lawyers, and these two lawyers I know to be good lawyers, are going to argue that this was some government-wide conspiracy. But I think for those of us who know the history, we'll recognize how unlikely that was and is.
Jen?
One of the central facts here that Trump actually tried to get in and was denied in one of those motions in limine was evidence that the Southern District did not prosecute him for these crimes. They had a very different take on not only Trump's general financial status, but on bringing any charges whatsoever. So the notion that they are colluding seems bizarre in lieu of Trump's own motion, which was he wants to bring those people in to say there's no big deal.
Yeah. Though, again, I think that's all they are. I've been on the other side of those turf battles with Mary Jo White and wound up with tire tracks on my back. But the main point is it's hard to see anything hardball. Yes, but it's hard to see anything illegal, nefarious, and certainly prejudicial to Trump. So hopefully Merchan gets to that point quickly. Well, we'll see. Can we leave that for now? When this is published, we'll know a lot more. Can we move down the street to Tish James, the New York AG? And tomorrow, the deadline for Trump to produce a bond of nearly $500 million to forestall execution of the judgment that's now 30 days old. Thoughts about whether Trump will, you know, slip the noose, as it were? Renato, everyone knows you, but you know, nevertheless, I'm letting you, you're the also a former federal prosecutor, but you host the It's Complicated podcast. Sorry, go for it.
So I have to say, I can't say whether or not Trump's going to get special treatment, but if it was one of my clients, I can be I could be sure that my client would not. And that ultimately, just like everyone else in the state of New York, if you go to trial and you lose and the plaintiff is trying to collect, if you want to postpone that, you're going to have to get a bond. And the answer is going to be from the judge, if you're not able to get one, that, you know, the Court of Appeals is not going to give you more time. It's very, very difficult to obtain any sort of reprieve in that regard. Yeah. Realistically, I haven't seen a good reason on his end for why he's not able to. I mean, he's claimed that this is unprecedented, but there are plenty of companies who've had bigger judgments, at least a few in New York, but there have been others in other jurisdictions. And that's just part of the cost of doing business.
I mean, and everyone agreed the Court of Appeal, the Appellate Division hasn't weighed in. It'd be awfully weird for them to just let this all go and then all of a sudden parachute in on a Monday, right? When it seems a little unclear, it might be that she can even execute first thing Monday. Well, okay, Norm.
What will she do tomorrow? I mean, let's assume that Trump does not produce the bond. I'm just curious, like, you know, what does she get? I mean, my thought was, if she's smart, she says the, Seven Springs is going to be the newest New York State Park. And I just don't know what else. I'm not familiar with this kind of civil litigation. So I'm just curious sort of how this all will unfold starting tomorrow.
Norm Ornstein, Senior Fellow Emeritus at the American Enterprise Institute.
I had a couple of questions on this, Harry. The first is, I would imagine that the judge will call in his monitor, Judge Jones.
Barbara Jones.
First, yeah. Ask whether Trump actually does have $500 million in cash in the bank. And if so, tell me if I'm wrong. Wouldn't that be the first thing that would be seized? You take the cash. So at least you start with whatever cash he has, and presumably she knows that. And at the same time, he can ask her to go through what the assets are and what other liens and mortgages there are on those properties. So it provides an opportunity to really unmask his wealth and what it is. And we know that he may get an infusion, although it's not a real infusion. It's a paper infusion with the Truth Social opening. And it is very, very likely that whatever that comes out at, which will be engineered by Yass and other Republican billionaires, that its value will plummet very quickly. So that's not going to be feasible for him to hang on to unless somebody makes arrangements to give him more money right away. But what struck me the most about this case in the last week was the additional powers that the judge gave to his monitor, who by every account is a tough, honest broker, former judge. Trump may castigate his attorneys, who quickly agreed early on that she would be a fine independent monitor. But that's got to be something that may be almost as significant as whether they start to seize assets.
Okay, let me just take a stab at your questions and people jump in if I have it wrong. I mean, first, presumably, if he actually has that amount of cash, we don't get there because he posts it. That's how he gets the bond. And likewise, True Social, you're right. It is like a lot of paper shuffling in a way, and it won't do on its own. Some billionaire type, and this is something that, you know, we all have to be nervous about as a country, will come in and say, that's good enough for me, for whatever reasons that billionaire, foreigner, domestic would say it. And then again, he freezes her out. So I think that's his rabbit out of the hat scenarios. If, on the other hand, he doesn't, and my best guess is something like that happens, but if it doesn't, where does she go? And some, you know, Karen or maybe Ellie Honig have a sense of this, but I think it's up to her, and I think she can do more than one at a time, but we do know that, as you say, it's one thing to seize cash, and that's fairly straightforward, and you present a piece of paper, but the presentation of a paper or of that judgment is really only the first of many procedural steps for any serious commercial property. And so it would just initiate a whole back and forth. And I gather if during that back and forth, he were able to come up with the bond, that would change the whole situation as well. But I think the initial drama is, does he make it? And I don't have any special insider sophistication, except he is so loathe and afraid of being a loser. And having come out on Friday and says he has that money, I just think something kind of happens. What about, first of all, anyone correct me, please, and jump in if I've gotten the process wrong, and it's incredibly complicated on what she does. But other thoughts about whether he one way or another manages to, you know, keep her from the reaper from reaping? Yeah, Jen.
Well, this once again is Trump being the world's worst defendant. You know, his attorneys have put in a slew of affidavits, papers saying he can't pay, it's impossible to pay, it's a practical impossibility. And on Friday, he comes out and says, sure, I got $500 billion. Yeah. So this is like the lawyer's nightmare, right?
Worst client in all time, yeah.
Absolutely. So the judge is, first of all, going to want to know why he's still pleading poverty if he is. But I do suspect that he's going to finally come up with the money. And listen, we should be suspicious from a national security standpoint. Who is giving him this money and why? And you also have to look at the money he's getting from Truth Social. Yes, is a holder in TikTok. So does this have anything to do with the fact that Donald Trump turned around on a dime and now is in favor of keeping TikTok an operating company? So goodness knows where he got the money or what he promised to people who's going to get the money. So I'm almost more interested in what happens when we find out he does have the money. I want to know where it came from and what he's given up to get it.
Well, Judge Barbara Jones is just the person for you, Jen Rubin.
Yeah, no, look, that is the silver lining. I do think whatever shenanigans he pulls, we will know. And I think that's in fact what the judge was thinking in bulking up her powers.
I have a trivia. It's Norm.
Norm, go.
I have a trivia question for you. And then a larger reflection on this 1-2 punch that Trump is facing in New York. The trivia question is, what law firm at one time or another contained Judge Barbara Jones, Norm Eisen, and Trump's defense lawyer, very able, John Lauro?
Zuckerman Spader.
Yes!
Zuckerman Spader.
Wow. Oh, yes. That was my old law firm.
Yeah, very good. And what would your point be, Norm Eisen?
Barbara came after I was.
And the question, the point?
Jeff was asking me if we were partners. No, I did practice with John, who's very.
And the point, the question.
The question is, the reflection is, how, for those who say that Trump is dodging accountability, look at how our first two topics are like walls closing in. If we're right, Karen, who knows New York so well, is right, that we are going to have the first criminal trial come mid-April, and it's a serious one. I think 34 serious election interference felonies for hiding information from voters in the last days of that election, and these cataclysmic financial penalties. Wow. you know, don't say there's no accountability. Now, we'll see how both of those go.
I just want to emphasize something that many of us have talked about amongst ourselves, that we have to say over and over again, this case is an election tampering case. This is an election interference case. That it involved a porn star and hush money is not what the case is about. The case is about using hush money after having an affair with a porn star to interfere with the outcome of an election, because otherwise it gets trivialized and people don't pay as much attention to it. It's a very deadly serious case that had an impact on the outcome of a presidential election.
Mary.
Just to follow up on Norm's point, I mean, you know, this was a deliberate, according to the statement of facts that we can assume that Alvin Bragg is prepared to prove up at trial, this was something that was discussed by, you know, between Trump and Cohen and David Pecker, the head of AMI that holds the National Enquirer. This was this catch and kill operation, right? Look for the bad stories, pay for them, kill them, squash them. And if listeners will recall, when that Access Hollywood tape came out, that seemed like it was something that could be very damaging for Trump. And if there had been additional information coming out, Stormy Daniels' story, as well as the stories of others who had had affairs with Trump, this could, at the time that this came out, right before the election, it was at least perceived by Trump and Cohen and David Pecker to be something so potentially damaging they were willing to pay to squash it. And that's where that election interference comes in.
Shan Wu?
Yeah.
By the way, it's former federal prosecutor and you were counsel to AG Janet Reno. Sorry. Yes, sir.
Well, I think one thing that's worth noting is that if Trump and his legal team really thought that Cohen's going to be such a lousy witness and that Stormy Daniels would be a bad witness, they wouldn't be so vehement in trying to have kept them off the stand. I mean, you know, in cases that I've had, if I think that there's going to be a weakness on the other side, I would be salivating to get them on the stand and tear them apart. I think it really shows that they know that these witnesses will be super damaging to them, on top of the fact as a documents case. That's what really makes the evidence for them. But these people are really going to bring it to life. And I think they're very, very much afraid of that. And they should be. Those are going to be very strong witnesses against them.
In fact, let me serve this up to the lawyers among us, because I think that, just as Mary said, that is both the way, the right prism for the case, but it's also the prism that Bragg will present. We've heard Trump suggest, or Team Trump anyway, that what really happened here was trying to spare the feelings of Melania Trump about the affair when she was home with her newborn son. Leaving that to the side, how would Trump prove? So you've just said it, Shan, the way that story comes in. Does Trump even have a way, short of taking the stand, and which raises that whole bramble bush, of presenting his story that it was just to spare Melania? I think as an evidentiary matter, it's a challenge. Thoughts there?
I think it's very hard for him to get that in a strong way without taking the stand. I mean, they could try to put someone else on to, you know, try and describe his state
objection
of
hearsay. Objection,
right,
hearsay.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. To get around the hearsay issue, I think it's quite problematic for him.
I don't know why they need a witness at all to argue that. I mean, he's married. This is a, you know, alleged affair. He wants to keep it from his wife. Why do you need a witness?
Ellie Honig is here, CNN senior legal analyst and former Fed and state prosecutor. Go, Ellie.
I agree with Jeff. I don't believe John Edwards testified in his trial. I might be wrong. Did John Edwards testify in his trial? I don't think he did. And
they just presented it final, right, closing argument.
They'll do what defense lawyers always do. No offense, Norm. Good defense lawyers. They just blurt it out in front of the jury. Like, they just say, well, I'm arguing inferences here. So I do believe that. The other thing that I think is important to keep in mind, I agree generally with the prognosticating that I've been hearing. I think it's likely we'll see a trial starting April, you know, May-ish. And I think he's likely, likely to be convicted, in no small part because this will be a Manhattan jury and not even an SDNY jury, because SDNY, at least we got to pull from Bronx and Westchester County. This will be a Manhattan jury. I think he's likely to be convicted. But when we discuss the crime, there is a tendency to fall back on just the, well, the hush money payments. He knew about the hush money payments. That will be undisputed, but that's not the crime that he knew about the hush money payments. The crime is the falsification. It's the way those payments were booked and logged internally in the Trump org. And so Michael Cohen, who I have said publicly, I consider a friend, I like him. I think will, when you hear Michael Cohen say, everything I say is corroborated, or I, someone earlier said, it's a paperwork case, not really on that key point of, did Donald Trump order, know about, bless the logging of these payments as legal fees? And to the contrary, the time when Michael Cohen recorded his client while he was still working for him, the infamous recording. Now, that had to do with the Karen McDougal payments. But listen to that recording. I played it the other day on air. I listened to it. Donald Trump is just deferring to Michael Cohen. Michael Trump says, how are we going to do this payment? Cash? And Michael Cohen says, no. Me and Alan are going to handle it. And I think there's a viable defense that, did Trump know about the hush money payments? Of course he did. But who did the logging? And the logging is the falsifying. That's the crime. And is it surprising that a person who runs a business would, when his lawyer says, me and the CFO are going to handle that, that the lawyer and the CFO would handle that? So it's that's the trick here. That there's no documentary corroboration that I know of for Donald Trump said, knew, blessed to do it that way, which is going to turn largely on Michael Cohen's testimony. I still think it'll result in a conviction, but it's not quite a slam dunk of course he knew about hush money.
Got it. Jen?
Well, one reason, going back to the issue of Melania, that we know this wasn't to protect her feelings was that as soon as Trump was elected, he said, do I still have to pay? Which is a classic Trump statement, because as he's paying hush money, he still wants to cheat her, because that's how he treats all contractors, all people who he owes money to, which is like, is there some way I can get out of this? So by saying that, of course, he is acknowledging that it's not for Melania's feelings. He doesn't give a hoot about Melania's feelings. It was only important to him because this followed the Access Hollywood tape, and he was afraid that this would dash his hopes of being president. Once he got elected, he didn't care what she had to say.
Yeah.
Melania be damned.
And by the way, this goes to Ellie's point of how things are going to be proven, because Mayor Chan has had a series of pretrial rulings of what can come in and what can't. And by and large, he's letting the DA tell a large story that includes Access Hollywood, includes even 2020. But he's setting ground rules about what Trump can't do. So to this general gambit that I believe Trump will try of, question, isn't it true there were lawyers? Isn't it true? Immediate objection, sidebar, and Mayor Chan, I think, will have the rulings in place to try to discipline him, though it'll be sort of a challenge. All right, Joyce Vance, thanks for joining, former U.S. Attorney for Northern District of Alabama.
So I actually have a practice question for the lawyers that I think touches on this question that we were asking about Melania and whether this was election interference or just an effort to protect his wife. It seems to me that putting Stormy Daniels on the stand is really tough, right? Because in some sense, you have to cross-examine her, right?
Yeah.
But you can't really cross-examine her because she is Stormy Daniels, and there is no telling what's going to come out of her mouth and how much more damaging it will be to you, both to your electoral prospects and the prospect of criminal conviction. So what would you all do? How would you handle a Stormy Daniels cross-examination if you were Trump's lawyers?
Okay, two questions on the floor. Renata, will you answer Joyce's? But Norm, have you answered Jeff's yet?
So, and this is Renata. The way I would handle that cross, I'd say two things that I would do. First is I'd limit the cross. It would be very, very narrow. I would ask her a few questions and sit down, okay? Things that she
100%,
she cannot answer differently. And I would make clear to the jury when I was crossing her that I was treating her with kid gloves and that I understood that this was a difficult situation and she was put in a difficult situation. So I was not going to give her a room to get sympathy for herself or use it as an opportunity to contrast some of my time.
Okay, Norm, go.
So here's how you'll prove the point. Of course, hush money payments are not legal fees. It is obvious on its face. Why do we think that even though this is about 34 felony document falsification counts for this set of hush money payments, that they're bringing in the full pattern of the AMI dealings with Trump, of Dino, the doorman, of Karen McDougal? This was an elaborate scheme to which Michael Cohen pled guilty and was convicted, and which many people get tripped up on, of making a set of payments for the purpose of affecting the outcome of an election. And there is a mountain of evidence of it. I think they will persuade the jury that was the purpose.
I think we now have the components of it. So, you know, will it make it or not? But Michael Cohen and the fact, we know Trump knows he signs the check, right? And we know he knows that. And then you add that to Norm's point. Is there anything else I'm missing? You're right. That's an important thing they've got to prove.
I'll add one other thing, because Michael Cohen is an important witness for this. He was the first witness that I interviewed when I went to do the Trump impeachment, because it was at the very beginning of 2019, because corrupt procurement of office is a classic Anglo-American ground for impeachment.
Jen.
One of the reasons we know that Trump knew what was going on was the comment that I just made a little while ago, which was he was going to stop making the payments. So he knew they weren't legal fees to Michael Cohen. They were hush money payments. So he knew that the checks he was writing was not going to legal services, but was going to her.
But Ellie's point, which I think, yes, all of that is true. But the question is, Donald Trump could say, or his lawyers could say, I run a multi-billion-dollar company. I don't know how things are characterized. Sure, it was hush money. Fine, it was hush money. If some accountant put it down as a legal fee, that's not my problem. I didn't know about it. Isn't that right, Ellie? Isn't that the point?
That's exactly it. Even if he signs some of the checks, but the crime is the logging of it, the internal ledger entries. Who's to say he ever even saw any of those ledger entries? Maybe Michael Cohen.
First, I want to say, I think we've surfaced everything and you've identified a challenge for the DA. But he doesn't have to understand the accountant's rules. What he has to understand is they're playing around to conceal its genuine nature, not exactly how, you know, filings work in the New York system, I think. Norm, you still had a comment.
Very quickly. Michael Cohen was the first witness I interviewed in the impeachment. He has not wavered one bit in his testimony from that day to this day. And Judge Engoron found him to be candid. I think the jury is going to believe him on this. And when you fold that together with the long pattern that started with AMI of paying hush money to affect the election, the jury will be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt.
All right. Anyway, so I hear that, but everyone also has to acknowledge this is a problematic witness and it'll be quite a cross-examination. But I think, Jeff, we've given you all there is. Let's try to take a minute or two. Fulton County, Fonnie Willis says, train is ready. None of this. This has all been a distraction. She's ready for trial. Is that true? Is it just posturing? And posturing or not, any thoughts about whether that trial actually occurs before the election? Gwen Keyes is invaluable to talk to, but especially on matters of Fulton County. So Gwen, please.
So first of all, can we just stop for a moment and appreciate the fact that we are talking about a former president who has four different cases that we are trying to methodically walk through. And so I just got to let that sit for a moment. But in terms of the DA in Fulton County, I think all of us who are former prosecutors, you know, the prosecutor is always ready. You would never suggest anything else. And I think in this particular case, knowing Fani as I do, she is actually ready. She may feel as though it's time to get back to business with the actual underlying facts of this case, as opposed to what has been in the news for the last several months. I think on the timing issue, the only problem here is how quickly the Court of Appeals may move in terms of whether they're going to agree to hear the case after the defendants have requested or the judge has provided a certificate of review. They've got two options. One is to have it on their April calendar, which obviously is very close. The other is to put it off until their September docket, which means they may not have to have a decision until sometimes next year. I think that is
a decision whether to hear it or a decision on the case, because they can hear it within, they have 45 days.
They have the 45 days to decide. Right. But make if they accept it, then and it gets put on the September docket, then we're looking at a decision sometime into 2025. This is a bench. It really just depends. I mean, I think these are judges that would recognize how important it is to move quickly, just like the Georgia Supreme Court justices recognized that earlier on in a matter that they were asked to review. I think it was last fall. But again, I think she's lost control of the timing a little bit, as much as she has tried to maintain it, regain it in light of everything that we've been through over the last couple of months.
John?
Yes, I certainly defer to Gwen on what's going to happen with the Court of Appeals, but people have seemed to have forgotten they haven't yet taken the case. So that is important. But I thought it was very telling the circumstances in which she spoke yesterday. CNN just caught her with a camera at a private event. It wasn't a press conference. She was totally off guard, but totally prepared. And she is not embarrassed by her problems, the smear they have put on her, which has been pretty effective. She admits that she made a mistake, but she also says she did nothing that she feels was wrong. So it may have been a slip of judgment, but she is looking at the case and has made very clear that she has stayed prepared. Her office is fully geared up to go, and she's seeking the time to try that case. So hopefully that will be the case, because it's such an important case since it's the only one that will be televised.
And in terms of appeal, I can't see they're reversing what the defendants are appealing. It's so obvious, not a financial conflict of interest. And I thought the second half was more controversial, but I believe the state isn't appealing that. So it should be straightforward. Gwen, could I ask you a quick question? We hear these estimates, outlandish estimates of jury selection here taking 3 months, 4 months. And of course, that totally would throw out of whack any chance of seeing it. What's the deal with RICO cases in Fulton County? And is that an accurate assessment for this case?
So I think everybody is pointing to the wrong precedent here in terms of jury selection. Everybody's looking at the most recent case in Young Thug, where it took 10 to 12 months to get a jury. That is a very different case. It's a violence case, the judge is different. All of the RICO cases that I am familiar with in my 17 years, they might have taken 3 to 5 weeks to be able to get a jury. I think that's what we'll see here too. In speaking with some others, you may also want to think that there may be folks that actually want to be on this jury for whatever reason, depending on which side of whatever they feel about the defendants. So I think the Young Thug case is an anomaly. It's very different and should not be used as the bellwether as to how long it will take to get a jury in this one.
Jan.
Yeah, and you know, Gwen's point is one which we just don't hear enough about in the coverage. That distinction, all we hear about is how long the jury selection has taken in that case. That's really important. The other thing I think we're hearing too much about, which in my opinion, we should put to rest, is this idea that the smear campaign, I agree with John, was really a smear campaign that just went through, that put her through on the disqualification, is somehow damaged her ability to put on the case or the prosecution's strength in the evidence. It has zero effect on that. I mean, maybe it has a problem for her in the future politically, But for the case, there is nothing that was done to it. And the talk that I will hear sometimes on air and in print that, oh, you know, this is just not as strong of a case as it used to be. That's just complete nonsense. The case is just as strong as it ever was.
Gwen?
I would have to agree with that. Again, for those of you that have worked for state prosecutors, they spend months out in the street at every chicken dinner, at every community event, at every religious event, really letting the citizens get to know them. And so she did that. They have known her. This is largely the only county that she's worked in. So they've been familiar with her work in terms of the press that she's received, even prior to running for office. I think what they have seen is she has gone through the fire. She has taken everything that they could possibly throw at her, and she's come out on the other side. Her white coat, that, you know, white cape that prosecutors sometimes think they wear, may be a little singed, but she is undeterred. And in terms of the political ramifications, again, I think she'll be able to weather those just looking at the opponents that she has in the primary. This is at least what my resources are saying. The opponents that she has in the primary, she should be able to survive that fairly well. And again, in the general election, it's a clear distinction. It's my understanding that the Republican opponent is very entrenched in the Trump camp. And so she will have that taint going into the election. And I don't think it will play well with the Fulton County jury.
Ellie?
So thanks. I always respect and appreciate both John Dean and Gwen Keyes. There's no way this case is getting tried before the election. I think it's a disservice to our audience to suggest that that's even a possibility. It is not happening. And Gwen brings very good perspective on the 10-month jury selection versus your standard maybe 1 month. But if anything, isn't Donald Trump going to be higher profile and more controversial and more fraught? Let's say it takes 4 months. They're not going to get this thing started in time. They wouldn't even finish it. Even the DA has said her proposed timeline is let's start in August and it'll run into 2025. It's just not happening. I think this will be the last of the four criminal cases tried, if ever. But I mean, really, does anyone on this call, there's 15 people on this call, think there's more than a 10% chance this case gets tried to verdict before November 5th of this year? Anyone? Jen Rubin has her hand up.
I don't disagree with that, but it's also not directly relevant. There were a couple things that struck me about Fani Willis's comment. One was the part that wasn't so well televised and bandied about, which was she said she doesn't feel like she has to restore her reputation. And that to me is a very positive sign, meaning she's not going to cross file for any kind of appeal. She's not going to drag this out. She wants to get back to the case because the case is the best thing that she's got going. And the second thing is, whenever this thing is tried, I think people underestimate the impact that her testimony and her appearance had with Fulton County voters, women, and African Americans, who were literally cheering her. When she came back with her retorts, they were thrilled. What this white male judge says was inappropriate behavior, that was what was all over social media, what made her, if you will, a little bit of a social media star. So the degree to which they think that the case has been damaged, I think it's the opposite. Who do they think is going to come as a juror? It's going to be Fulton County residents, many women, many African Americans. So this notion that somehow it's been damaged or it was going to get to trial except for this, I think is just wrong. And although it won't come to trial before the election, it doesn't mean it's not important. It doesn't mean that the trial shouldn't be held or that the people of Fulton County don't get a chance to rectify an attempt to throw their votes out. Remember what this is about. Okay. This is Donald Trump attempting to tell a very largely African-American community, your votes don't count. I'm going to go to this other white guy, Brad Raffensperger, and he's going to, quote, find votes so that your votes don't count.
So, Ellie, I don't think I've ever said that the case would be to verdict, by the election. And I think you're right. That's unrealistic. But what I can see happening is if in a best case, and I realize it's a best case scenario for the DA's office, but if they are able to start in August, have a jury by the first or second week in September, remember the prosecutors are going to go first. So that's a good 2 months of testimony before you get to November 5th. And then you know, obviously we'll hear from the defense, but something that's going to be covered every day in the press for 2 months. And I've seen that sort of dynamic work in terms of other sheriffs and other elected officials that have lost office because of that level of press attention.
Oh, it's Norm Eisen who wanted to come in. I would have never imagined. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just wanted to add, it's on, to Gwen's point, it's on television. It is going to be the top rated show in America for September, October, and the first part of November. If it happens. I understand the skeptics about whether it'll happen, but I'm not ruling it out.
All right, Ellie Honig.
The point about whether this will be on TV and a huge deal is that's a straw man argument. Nobody, I'm not arguing to the contrary. Of course it will be. There's no way we're going to be mid-trial all right up through the election. That's just as a practical matter, it's just not going to happen. I mean, I don't know why we stoke this fantasy. There's not going to be a trial starting in August, running up through November and December and during the election. Just like, we have to be practical here. The other thing I want to say about Fani Willis, I forget who made the point. I think it's a very good point. Maybe Jen Rubin, that I do think some of what happened in that hearing will redound to Fani Willis's benefit. There clearly was a lot of support for her. But does anyone on this call have any concerns about the, and look, a lot of the people on this call have spent a lot of time over the last 6-7 years as acting as prosecutorial purists. And I count myself among that. None of us is perfect, but I wrote a whole book excoriating Bill Barr. And a lot of us insist on the highest standards of prosecutors. I mean, we have a judge here who I think people can agree has been relatively a straight shooter, who made findings that the odor of mendacity, there are real questions about whether the DA testified untruthfully and made legally improper statements at the church, and they were legally improper. Does anyone have a single word of condemnation for Fani Willis's conduct? Does anyone actually believe her testimony about that she didn't start this romantic relationship till after?
Shan, last word to you and Mary, quick word, and then I really want 40 seconds of Mar-a-Lago.
I yield my time to Mary. Okay.
So I think as we talk about this timing, I think we're leaving out a really, really important fact, which is that hopefully the Supreme Court will clear the way for Jack Smith to start his case. They're either going to clear that way in May or maybe June or maybe the very first day of July. And so, you know, if Jack Smith is then able to get back in front of Judge Chutkan and get going in August or even September, I think we'll see Fani Willis yield to that. And I think that's probably what we'd all prefer to see. Or at least me. That's what I'd prefer to see.
All right, it is now time for a spirited debate brought to you by our sponsor, Total Wine and More. Each episode, you'll be hearing an expert talk about the pros and cons of a particular issue in the world of wine, spirit, and beverages.
Thank you, Harry. In today's spirited debate, we hop into the beer cooler to ask the question, to IPA or not IPA? The India Pale Ale has become synonymous with the word hoppy. And it's that hoppiness that's created a bittersweet relationship with IPAs that has divided beer lovers across the world into two categories. Those who love this style of the pale ale for its full-flavored bite with flavors of lemon and pine needle, plus typically higher alcohol content. And then those who prefer a little less sharpness with each sip. So what gives IPAs that signature bite? Well, there's another abbreviation you should know, IBU, which stands for International Bitterness Units. The higher the IBU, the more bitter the beer. Luckily, at Total Wine & More, we carry an array of IPAs that offer up a huge range of hoppiness. We've all been bitten by a hoppy IPA in our past. Swing by your local Total Wine & More and let our guides find you an IPA that's more YOU. So find what you love and love what you find. only at Total Wine & More. Cheers!
Thanks to our friends at Total Wine & More for today's A Spirited Debate.
I really want to hear the assembled thoughts about what Jack Smith is to do about the perennial problem that is Eileen Cannon, because one of the things she seems to me to be doing is preventing any kind of order that could be appealed, this current bizarre academic discussion of jury instructions. I don't see, it's very hard to kind of, you know, get your hands around as a possible appealable order. And so just anyone have any thoughts about whether and when the Jack Smith will move to recuse Eileen Cannon? Joyce Vance.
So look, I have the same view on this topic that I've had from the get-go, only stronger at this point. I think the government should move to recuse Eileen Cannon. Here's the problem.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now for certain. Here's the problem. Once they get into trial and she makes rulings, for instance, on the admissibility of evidence or on crazy stuff like finding that the Presidential Records Act gives Trump a defense, they're in a posture where they can't appeal her because double jeopardy has attached. And as long as she makes those rulings without letting the case go to the jury and the jury convicts, then the government is out of business. So here's how it works. If they file a motion to recuse, she actually has to respond in writing if she denies it, explaining her reasons. And that should give them a basis for going to the 11th Circuit. It's nobody's first choice. The position that you want to be in is appealing a substantively bad motion and then going. But this is a judge who has refused, for instance, to rule on the Presidential Records Act where they could appeal her. And I think that fuels the argument that she has to be set aside. No one will have confidence that she's being fair. And that's the standard in the 11th Circuit. It's so rare to recuse a trial judge for actions that they take in a certain case. But here she meets the standard that this circuit has used in the past to recuse a judge.
Mary.
Yeah, I don't really disagree. I think it's really a hard standard to meet. And the point that Joyce made that really resonates with me is that she's got to respond, right? So then you have something on the record with her responding. I still think it's hard for the government. And I guess I'm leaning toward the government potentially first seeking a writ of mandamus, basically saying she is refusing to make the legal rulings that are in front of her as a result of these motions, the Presidential Records Act, and even vagueness, right? She denied vagueness without prejudice to re-raise this issue in the context of jury instructions at trial. So she seems to be trying to avoid making the legal rulings she's been made asked to do and which she's got a responsibility to make and to try to push everything into trial. And as Joyce says, after double jeopardy attaches. Now, mandamus is tough. Clear and indisputable error. But if Jack Smith could get a favorable ruling on that, and I think it's really getting to the point where I think he's got a good argument there, that would make recusal an easier lift, in my opinion.
All right, two strategies for an immediate motion against Cannon, and that I think will have to be the end for now. I really hope we can do this again, maybe on the eve of the actual proceedings in New York. But thanks to, I won't even say it, there are so many great minds here, but for being here, and we ought to do it again. Bye-bye. We are out of time in this very special Talking Feds. That was a kind of wild and fun, and I hope informative ride. Thank you so much to our crew of expert commentators, and thank you very much, listeners, for tuning in to Talking Feds. If you like what you've heard, please tell a friend to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever they get their podcasts, and please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube, where we post full episodes, talking books, and bonus video content. You can follow us on Twitter at Talking Feds Pod, and you can look to see our latest offerings on Patreon. Talking Feds is a completely independent production, so if you like the work we do and are inclined to support the show, joining our Patreon is the best way to do it. And you can now leave voicemails with your questions for me and our guests. Whether it's for Talking Five or general questions about the inner workings of the legal system for our sidebar segments, all you have to do is call 727-279-5339 and leave a voice message. That's 727-279-5339. And you can still also, of course, email us your questions at questions@talkingfeds.com. Thanks for tuning in, and don't worry. As long as you need answers, the feds will keep talking. Talking Feds is produced by Catherine Devine. Associate producer Meredith McCabe. Sound engineering by Matt McArdle. Our research producer is Zeke Reed. Rosie Don Griffin and David Lieberman are our contributing writers. Production assistance by Akshaj Turbailu, and our music by the amazing Philip Glass. Special thanks to Norm Eisen for his organizational help with this episode. Talking Feds is a production of DeLito LLC. I'm Harry Littman. Talk to you later.